Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Councilmember Chris Robbins and recapping yesterday's meeting. The Director of Counseling for the Christian Center of Park City, Leah Harder, with details on a couple of upcoming events for Mental Health Awareness Month here in May. And finally, Summit Community Gardens Executive Director Sloan Johnson with details about the opening of the gardens and the lineup for dinners in the garden coming up as well. Taking a look at local news now, the union representing the ski patrollers at Park City Mountain Resort and resort representatives will continue negotiations this month after their contract expired May 1st. Sean Higgins has details.
The Outlaw Golf Club at Hideout Canyon. After an unprecedented winter for the ski industry amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the ski patrollers at PCMR and resort representatives were also locked in negotiations to update their employment contract. Even though PCMR's season ended in mid-April, those negotiations are set to extend at least until later in May. The union, called the Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association, had been unsuccessful in securing a new employment contract over the course of the winter after their last contract expired in November. The union agreed to an indefinite extension last fall before terminating the contract in January due to lack of progress in the bargaining process. The union then re-entered the contract extension in March to finish out the season. That extension expired on May 1st. KPCW reached out to both the union and PCMR, and both parties confirmed that bargaining is scheduled to resume on May 17th, with other sessions to be scheduled if necessary. The union is hoping to secure a pay raise and expand access to sick time as part of a new contract, and ultimately hope to make patrolling a more viable career option for medical and avalanche professionals. The union's previous contract was negotiated in 2018. The ski patrollers at PCMR voted 97-94 to unionize in 2015 after the merger of Park City and then Canyons Resort. Ski patrollers at Breckenridge Ski Resort in Colorado, another property owned by PCMR parent company Vail Resorts, narrowly voted 43-42 to unionize earlier this week. PCMR spokesperson Jessica Miller told KPCW the resort is committed to reaching a new multi-year agreement with the union. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday and once again pushed back a decision on the proposed mixed-use zone. On the phone with the meeting recap, I have Councilmember Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Leslie.
So the council, instead of making a decision, decided to form a subcommittee that is with you, Councilmember Doug Clyde, and then Peter Barnes and Pat Putt from the Planning Department and Deputy County Attorney Dave Thomas. A lot of staff resources right there. What's the purpose of this subcommittee?
The purpose is to determine language that should be that would be in the NMU ordinance that would require, if multifamily is one of the three mixed uses, a certain standard, a high standard for affordable housing.
So you do want to put some language in there to give some direction about affordable housing?
Yes.
And what would that look
like? Well, I don't know exactly what it looks like. I have, you know, my opinions, which I've shared in the past and can repeat now, but in general, you know, we have an inclusionary ordinance that says if you want to build retail or if you want to build office or even residential, you have to have 20% inclusion area. This NMU is incentive zoning, and so it's separate from the inclusion, in my mind, from the inclusionary, and it needs its own provisions, and we went back and forth, and I think where it was left is that this subcommittee would propose to the body of the whole language that hopefully would be satisfactory, and if we're going to provide the incentive of multifamily, which is a very strong incentive, in other words, the market really likes it, it's lucrative, that the counterweight to that is that there be a significant portion of it that's workforce or affordable.
Yeah. So what about just waiting on the zone until the council has finished the makeover of Chapter 5, which deals with affordable housing in the development code?
Two things on that. The course laid out by Jeff Jones yesterday would require a needs assessment, then revision to the general plan, then revision to the land use code, and I think it would take a long time, maybe a year. And the second thing is, as Dave Thomas pointed out, our chief civil attorney, the inclusionary Chapter 5 language is really separate and needs to be kept separate from this incentive zoning. This incentive, this NMU is a discretionary action, and the it's awarded based on it by the developer receiving, doing things in exchange for an incentive. And in this case, the multifamily is the incentive, and I think it should be kept separate.
So you put forward the idea that 50% of the residential development could be affordable. Do you know how the developer who's kind of waiting for this zone to happen, Henry Sigg, feels about that requirement?
No. I mean, the when I talk about 50%, I think that, as in everything, Leslie, the devil's in the details. What percents of AMI are we talking about? Are we talking about, 180, 60, 120? And for the listeners, AMI is area median income, and it's a measure of how affordable we're making it. And I haven't talked to Henry about this, but I think we need to come up with a pretty high standard, whether my 50% and the devilish details surrounding it, what they need to be, I don't know.
So given the parameters that this zone already allows, setbacks and building heights, this could be a mixed-use area, could be a very dense area. More so, affordable housing now would allow height exceptions from 45 to 60 feet tall. Have we just increased the density by a third? If we're increasing the amount of affordable housing that's part of this?
I don't totally follow your nexus between the height and affordable housing. I may need to look at that.
Well, the parameters, as I understand, if affordable housing is built, you would get the height exception from 45 to 60.
I think that may be discretionary on the part of the council, but that's an unintended consequence in my mind. In other words, in the NMU, and it's the same in community commercial, there is no set square footage or density. It's based on, with all the other rules, how much can you fit in there? 25% open space, setbacks, height restrictions. And to your point, if you raise the height by a third, then you're adding more volume, right, in this kind of cube that we're creating after you set everything back and have your open space. But my point is that if it's not, let's just say it's all market, then we have built clustered, nodal, mixed-use development, pretty dense development, but all we've done is now we just got more units. You know, the counterweight to the more units is that there needs to be meaningful, affordable housing, in my mind. And if you're saying that we're requiring affordable housing and therefore we've added a third to the volume because we've gone from 45 to 60 feet, I need to look closer at that.
Mm. All right. And then, again, how this fits in with what we already have on the books, the Section 2.3 that says no new density unless there is a compelling public benefit. So basically you're just saying affordable housing allows, density like this in perhaps a rural residential zone currently?
Well, this is the theory that this mixed-use neighborhood is going to have services in it. It will, the people that live there will have transit. They will have they won't have to leave the community for every little thing. And how we apply this tool against the backdrop of Section 2.3 of the general plan that requires that compelling public benefit remains to be seen. Our staff, and I believe the majority of the council, believe that this is a valuable tool, or will be, but we've been deliberate, and some say, you know, too slow in figuring it out, but we want to get it right. And how we weigh the countervailing public interest, the compelling public interest, will remains to be seen. But I think there will be instances where we will find that it meets the test.
Okay. Let's see, the master plan development process that kind of goes along with this new zone, the council didn't get to, and I guess, was it just because of all of the time you spent talking about what we just talked about?
Pretty much. I don't think the MPD needs a lot more work. We've been through it. Most of the remaining work is in finalizing the NMU and getting this affordable business right.
Okay. And then what's the timeline then on this subcommittee? Do you expect us to meet once, twice, or could it be another month? Or
well, we have a lot to do, but I hope it's soon. I don't think it would take more than a meeting to come up with draft language.
Okay. Let's see. Summit County Attorney Margaret Olson presented plans for a conviction integrity unit. We're going to talk to her about this next week, but what did you think about the unit and the presentation?
I thought it was great. The legislature passed a law in 2020 that provides guidance on how to create these units. And they're designed to make sure that we don't wrongfully, convict people. And it provides an avenue. It has this unit has a chair, which will be my council member, Roger Armstrong, and six other citizens chosen strategically that will evaluate cases that are brought before them, and if there's been a wrongful conviction, that they will provide a means, or if there's evidence that that perhaps there has been new evidence comes to light, be it DNA or new witnesses or alibis or whatever, I think it's a good thing. We're the third county in the state to do it, behind Salt Lake and Utah, and Margaret again is led off in a great way.
All right. I believe the council approved the bonding for up to $8.8 million. This is going to be based on the sales tax revenues expected from the Recreation Arts and Parks Recreation Fund. Any idea what that money will go toward, or are you just still waiting for ideas?
We have a robust committee for evaluating applications for that money, and I have no idea where it will go, but we have a good process. And this, every decade we have to renew the tax. It went to the voters and was, you know, by a supermajority approved. And this is a great time to be bonding. It's a lot more money than we had 10 years ago. I think it was some $3.5 million 10 years ago. And it will borrow for less than 2%, and it'll be fully amortized over the 10-year life of the bond, and also over the remainder of the 10 years that it'll be authorized until the next time.
All right. Let's see. During public comment, the council heard from a couple of homeowners concerned about trail use in their neighborhoods. I think that we were talking about Bear Hollow Drive. Have you heard concerns about this?
Just from the person that commented, though there were two people, but I think in general we're doing better with, you know, the comments I hear are that the presence of our enforcement people are good, that we've signed a lot of places as no parking. There's still a fair amount of violation of that, but it's a little better. It's going to be a process.
And what were they asking for? More enforcement?
Well, yeah, and clarification. There also had been some complaints about people building campfires, having a weenie-wood roast and along the trail or, somewhere in the right-of-way, which, of course, is very unwise in most seasons of the year. All dangerous.
Right. Wanted to also ask you, the county council as a whole, any concerns about Park City's plans to build the contaminated soil repository there kind of on the Summit County's border?
We had an opportunity on Tuesday the 4th, which was the deadline, to submit comments to Utah DEQ on the proposed Gordo landfill. And the main thrust of our comments were that we're sympathetic with the city's need to find a soil solution. We have similar needs, and it's not a great answer to haul things out of the county and pay exorbitant freight and tipping fees. There were some statements in the application about setbacks from playing fields and streams, and we questioned those, but we want an open and a good process, and I think these soils are in many places in this drainage from Prospector down to I-80 through Silver Creek. We have worked hard with the EPA, as you know, to come up with a means of both protecting and rehabilitating part of the Gilmore property that's down by Home Depot. And the intent there is that there would be this similar sort of remediation where the contaminated soils are put on site in an upland area and capped, and that's basically what is being proposed by Park City. The ideal place to do that would have been at Richardson Flat in my mind, but in the existing repository, but that is very contested ground with the bankruptcy of United Park City Mines, the foreclosure by Wells Fargo, the hideout machinations, the litigation. It's a hornet's nest of controversy, and the city has been temporarily storing these materials at Gordo, some, I understand, 35,000 cubic yards so far. And then this ongoing need, and you could say, well, just wait it out. But I think that coming up with a rational solution is a good idea. And as long as they go through a good process, I think that's the important thing. But these soils are, in Prospector, they're all along the rail trail coming out down to Richardson. They're all through Silver Creek.
They're everywhere. They're in Park Meadows. They're in Thames. They're anywhere that road work was done back in the 80s. That's
right.
Sure.
And yeah. I think it's good to get them in a responsible place, but I don't think the sky is falling.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden we're going to start growing a third eye or keeling over.
Sure. But why not some joint facility then, given the similar needs for, cleanup?
Well, what we in the county had done is the EPA had reserved at Richardson some 1.5 million cubic yards of storage for the lower Silver Creek, which is sort of in our jurisdiction, and not sort of, is in our jurisdiction, and we thought it would be smarter, rather than hauling it all up to Richardson, to find a way to remediate in place. And so We started out by purchasing the land and setting it up with EPA with a deed restriction and a covenant that remediation could occur on site. And so the county doesn't really have a need for a repository. Most of the remaining contaminants are in Park City limits, and it has big needs. I mean, every time they built Park City Heights and they did a repository or an in-place impoundment right there. Every time they build a crossing under 248 for, you know, a tunnel, or put a sewer water line in, or, you know, build a foundation for anything. They got to export the soil, and having a place to do that's been really important, and they've struggled with it for years and years, and finally they settled on this plan, and hopefully it'll be well vetted, and that the right thing will rise to the top. But we don't need one.
Okay.
We don't have big areas that we need to export, from which we need to export soils.
All right. Hey, Chris, I got to leave it there. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Beautiful day out there.
Okay.
For a change.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Summit County Council member Chris Robinson. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and as we've been reporting, a number of events are happening across the Wasatch Back. A number of them being hosted by the Christian Center of Park City. And on the phone with details, I have the Director of Counseling for the Christian Center, Leah Harder. Good morning, Leah.
Hey, good morning.
So you have told us before that the numbers that you're seeing for your counseling sessions keep growing. Has it backed off at all now that people are going back to work, leaving their homes?
You would think so, but no. In fact, we just continued to see growth. The last quarter of 2020, we did 1,400 sessions approximately, and then just even the current quarter, first quarter of this year, we saw, you know, 1,500 sessions approximately. So we're still seeing a 9% increase in demand. In fact, a 38% increase in adolescent sessions. The teens are not doing well, unfortunately. It's been a really rough, few months. And I think that people just don't realize that the pandemic may be kind of changing, but there's a lot of people that are super struggling. I've seen a lot of first responders, and, you know, they could deal with the trauma, but 18 months of, you know, dealing with intensity has built up. And I've seen several in my office coming in and just are in rough shape with the trauma and then everything else personally that's gone on in their own family lives and how they've been impacted. So teens are struggling. Teachers, man, they've really plowed through. What a year to teach. And they're worn out, burned out. And so I think that the ramifications for mental health are just going to keep rolling here. And I know we're just trying to hire as many staff clinicians as possible, but there's a huge demand and a big shortage of mental health workers to meet the need right now.
Yeah, and I hate to generalize, but when you talk about trauma and just tough times, I mean, what are specific issues that are so troubling to people? You mentioned burnout.
Well, I think of some of the frontline workers. You know, I think of a nurse practitioner that I'm working with right now. She was in the ICU at one of the local hospitals, and the trauma of, you know, they had people in the ICU that were on ventilators and that were dying, and she had to call families and let them know, and the families couldn't come in. And for her, that's been one of the most difficult things as a nurse practitioner. You're used to, you know, helping the family be able to work through kind of, the end stages of someone's life. And she just was so limited in being able to do that. So from that issue to, just people being just tired, like putting in massive amounts of hours, certain industries doing way more work and worn out, just tired and burned out.
Yeah. And so what are some of the strategies that your council has used then to help these folks? I mean, is it just sometimes talking and getting it off their chest that makes a difference?
Yeah, you know, you can only talk to your friends and family for so long. You know, they are tired too. They're worn out. They're beat down. And so really then coming to talk to a professional that is used to it, talking about these issues, that's what we do all day long. We're totally used to that, is really a support. And, our counseling center, all of our clinicians are trained with EMDR, which is a type of therapy that is super helpful for trauma and for anxiety issues. And so we've been using that like crazy, and really can see the decrease of symptoms very quickly. But even if someone's, you know, reluctant, doesn't know much about EMDR, there's lots of strategies of, you know, letting it out, looking at what can I control when there's lots of anxiety going on, what can I focus on? focusing, you know, just on what is known rather than all the unknowns. There's still a lot of unknowns out there, and people really need certainty to feel grounded. And yet we're living in extremely uncertain times. Even though people have been vaccinated, we don't know, you know, could we still pass it on? Could we? There's just still a lot of unknowns, and that creates lots of anxiety.
Okay, and this EMDR, I'm quickly Googling it. It's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a tremendous evidence-based model for treating trauma and anxiety. And one, we begin with just a lot of emotion regulation tools, which means calming tools, helping people learn how to calm their bodies, relax that nervous system that's been on the fight or flight place for months, and just try to reel it in and find that sense of calm again. So we begin with a lot of strategies towards that. And then we can use it to target specific anxiety, or we can use it to target, you know, traumatic events or traumatic experiences. The nurse practitioner I'm working with, we're using it to target specifically those memories that she has of trauma being in the ICU for weeks.
Hmm. All right. Well, given the extra load that therapists have been taking on this last year, how do they get the help that they might need spending their days listening to very troubled people?
Yeah. You know, we have to do our own self-care. I don't know anybody in the caregiving field that can't. You know, you've got to do your own work. So one, we support each other. We meet for collaboration meetings and just let us be ourselves. We have done a lot more socials just as a team to let us have a place to let out our hair a little bit. And then just each one of us as clinicians have to find ways to release. There's a great Brené Brown is I'm a pretty big fan of, and she has her podcast, and she's got a great podcast on she interviews someone who wrote the book Burnout. And we each have to find our ways to release the stress cycle she talks about. You can't just build up stress and not expect there to be consequences to you. You will have insomnia. It will affect your life in some way. You'll be all tense. So looking at how do I release my tension? Do I go for a walk? Do I talk to a friend? Do I need to just sit in the sun? Like, what do I need to do to release the stress that I carry? You know, I think it's a strategy we all have to use.
All right. Well, let's talk about a couple of the events that the Counseling Center has organized for Mental Health Awareness Month. The first one is happening May 16th. You're calling it Walk It Out. Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, this is a great opportunity for people to get outside, to be in nature, which is huge for healing, be in the sun. And we've got three team members, two of us clinicians, that are going to be talking about cultivation of different things. We're going to be talking about herbs and how they relate to dealing with anxiety and stress and uncertainty, and how to relax our minds, our bodies, and just our spirit. So we're super excited. That is coming up, like you said, May 16th at 12 o'clock and at 2:30. You do want to register online ahead of time so that we know you're coming. There is a cost, but you are going to get a lot out of that cost, including a swag bag, resources. I mean, it's like coming for a therapy session on the trail. You know, I think that people will really enjoy that chance, plus the chance to be with community, you know, to grab a girlfriend and just to come. And it will be a well worth hour and a half of your time.
All right. And that's what, there is some hiking involved in this?
Yeah. Yep. So we're going to meet right at the trail near the UOP to do the RTS loop. It's a beginner trail. It's not going to be hard. We're going to have a little bit of presenting, then a little bit of walking, and then stop a couple other times. So it's not for the advanced hiker, but just being outside and grabbing tools to support each other through all of this.
Okay, and then the other event is the Enneagram for Couples. This is part two. Did you have to be a part of part one to make sense of this?
No. So this is a great way. The Enneagram is something that has been really interesting for people to learn more about. The Enneagram is, you know, a way of understanding your personality, and especially through COVID, to understand the people that you live with or that you work with. So we've done different seminars throughout the month. It was so well attended in February that we decided to offer it again. And we're going to focus on the Enneagram. There's so much to learn about it, but one part of it is understanding the three instincts within the Enneagram system. And so it's going to be a virtual seminar. You just have to log on. It's $10 May 20th at 7 p.m. So really kind of a good introductory taste of the Enneagram. If you're interested in and especially how might it affect your relationship with a partner? You know, that's all of us. If you're living with somebody, whether it be a roommate or a, you know, a partner, or a husband or a wife, you know, this has been challenging times. And so the Enneagram is a way to understand, why am I like I am and why is my partner or roommate like they are?
Okay. Again, people can just go online, ccfpc.org/events, and they would find at least those registration for those free events.
Yeah. We would love to come on there. And, you know, just all of our resources at the Christian Center are there, whether it be our counseling services. We have two coaches, or it be some of the other resources that we do, the food pantry and our stores and different programs that'll be coming up this summer, ways to volunteer. There's a lot of good stuff happening.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, just that I always am going to encourage people to take care of themselves. These are not easy times. You know, the pandemic, the initial intensity is done, but take care of yourself. I hope these teachers can really enjoy their summers. I hope the first responders, doctors, nurses, all of them can really do some healing this summer. Just, you know, get away, be in the sun, because these are hard times.
All right. Leah Harder, Director of Counseling for the Christian Center of Park City. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Leslie. Have a good one.
Park City LGBTQIA plus Community Task Force is starting to take shape. Members of the new group spoke with KPCW about what the future might hold, and while the group is important for the greater Park City community, KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
In an effort to further Park City's social equity goals and give the greater LGBTQIA plus community in Park City a seat at the table of local government, the Community Task Force was formed in early February. Currently made up of just over a dozen Parkites, the group is working towards creating an LGBTQIA plus community in Park City that is more visible for individuals who are looking for a place to come together. Leah Langan is the executive assistant to the mayor and city manager in Park City and a founding member of the group. She said the group is still working out what their core mission will be and how the group will be structured, including determining whether or not to call the group a task force at all.
Right now, we're at the very beginning stages of figuring out who we are and what the focus is, but I think it leaves us with a lot of growth to move forward.
Langan was also part of an internal city task force that took a deeper look at things like city facilities and HR policies in order to become more inclusive to all of Park City's residents, visitors, and employees. Mitchell Walski is another member of the group and moved to Park City in early 2020 with his husband. He also created the Park City Pride Facebook page as a way to connect members of the community. He said at Tuesday's roundtable that a sense of community was something missing from his life when he first came out over a decade ago. He now hopes the Park City community can fill that gap for others who might be in a similar situation.
Visibility is definitely key, because when I came out of the closet forever ago, now it's 14 years now, I grew up in a tiny rural Nevada town, and there wasn't a representation of what it meant to be gay. I didn't have gay role models in my life. I didn't know what path I was on. I knew I was on it on my own, though, because I didn't have that sense of community when I was there. So starting this conversation, being visible, showing, hey, there are people like you within the community. Feel free to reach out, find your people, because we're out there, is definitely the biggest aspect.
The group will also be coordinating with Encircle, a Utah-based LGBTQIA plus youth and family center, which is expected to open a location in Heber later this year. Langan said the Park City Group is exploring branching out further into the greater Wasatch Back in the future, and as of right now, all options are being considered.
Should it be a interregional collaboration effort, or should we just start with Park City proper? So right now, you know, we don't want to be too constrictive in terms of where we're starting out, but right now all the ideas are on the table.
In the immediate future, the group is coordinating with the city to update the city's pride flags and banners for June's Pride Month, planning a pride picnic, and finalizing their participation in the city's 4th of July parade if and when the festivities are approved by city council. The group is also drafting a resolution to formally declare June as official Pride Month in Park City. That resolution is expected to be in front of city council later this month. The group's meetings occur on the last Monday of every month. More information on the group can be found through a link on our website, kpcw.org, or you can email lgbtqia@parkcity.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Summit Community Gardens opens for the growing season later this month. On the phone with a look ahead, I have the executive director of the gardens, Sloan Johnson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with opening weekend, happening May 22nd and 23rd. So what happens then?
Yeah, so opening weekend is just basically a time for everybody to get together, get into their garden plots. All our staff will be there, and we'll have activities for the kids that want to come in. Natalie, our garden manager, is going to be walking around answering questions. So if you have any questions about gardening, she'll be there. She'll also do some demonstrations on how to prepare your garden plot. Even if you don't have a plot in the garden, this is a great opportunity to just come to the garden and learn more about how to prepare your garden. We'll also have a composting class and then information about volunteer opportunities and dinners in the garden and what's happening, all our classes and everything that we're going to be doing for the summer.
Okay, so how many plots have you leased out?
So we have 132 plots, and they're all rented out, and we do have a wait list. If you are on the wait list, there is hope still. You know, a lot of people rent plots, and then when they get in, realize they're traveling for the summer and ask to give them up. So, so hold on. There is a possibility if you're on the wait list, but right now everything is sold out.
All right. I think you're also scheduled to have a seedling sale then on that Saturday?
Yeah, so also during the opening weekend, we will be selling some seedlings. So we've been starting some plants in various greenhouses, and we'll have those available for sale.
Yeah, any idea what you'll have available?
That's a good question. We will have... I'm not 100% positive everything that Natalie's planted, but I know we'll have tomatoes, a couple tomato varieties. We will have some squash. I believe we planted some pumpkins. What else did you plant? I will have some kale, some Brussels sprouts, I believe.
Okay, I think I got a bunch of herbs last year too.
Yeah.
So we have had a couple of nice days this week, and a cold snap is headed our way. Is it still too early to plant outside?
So I know May is such a tough month because it's so beautiful, and if you're anything like me, all you want to do is get in the garden and start planting. So if you are planting, just make sure you have a frost cloth because it will freeze. You know, this time of year, you put a lot of work into your plants, and then just one night of not covering up, they'll all freeze. So it's not too early to plant as long as you have a good heavy frost cloth over what you're planting. I would stay away from planting starts, especially tomatoes or basil or anything that likes the warm weather. Hold off on getting those in the ground. But you can definitely plant more cold weather plants like spinach, anything in the cabbage family, getting radish seeds and turnip seeds in the ground, those will all do well this time of year.
Okay.
As long as you have them covered.
So you've got the lineup for Dinners in the Garden this summer. This is a fundraiser, I believe, for you. Tickets will go on sale May 15th unless you're a member of the Gardens. So maybe you can give us kind of the rundown. What have you got planned?
Yeah, so, we started our Dinners in the Garden series last year when we had COVID and we couldn't have our big fundraiser. And they were just so much fun. We had a great time. Everybody who came really had positive things to say. So we're continuing that this year. And so, yes, if you're a honeybee or a butterfly member, you can buy tickets now. Otherwise, they'll go on sale May 15th. And so our lineup is starting on June 3rd. We have a big barbecue in the garden. This is sponsored by the Chop Shop Park City. Chef John Courtney will be having an outdoor barbecue, open fire cooking. He has a wonderful butcher where he uses local meats. So that will be available with vegetables, and cocktails will be served at this dinner. So it's 21 and over. On June 17th, we have what we're calling our garden party. This is kind of going to be one of our biggest dinners in the garden. We have Lash LaRue is going to be playing. So we'll have a good band. This one's for 21 and older. Nosh is going to be the restaurant that will be providing food. And this dinner was sponsored by a garden supporter, Lauren Fielding. And so we really appreciate her sponsoring this dinner and making it happen. And so that's going to be a lot of fun. That'll have up to 80 people will be allowed to sign up for that one. On July 1st, we have River Horse is going to be sponsoring the next dinner. So this is going to be a nice sit-down dinner. And we will have music from Mountain Town Music for this one. So I don't know exactly who's going to be playing. And then on July 15th, we have Twisted Fern is going to do a farm-to-table garden dinner. And this is Chef Adam Ross on Twisted Fern. He did one last year, and it was fabulous. Just the food is so good and fresh, and this is just a great dinner. And then on August 5th, we have our Bee Lovers dinner. So we have entomologist McKay Joyce is going to be coming and doing a honey tasting. She's bringing honey from around the world. And this is going to be an educational dinner where you learn about bees and different pollinators and just the importance of bugs in our ecosystem. And there'll be local cheese plates and some local vegetables available. It'll kind of be like an appetizer, lots of appetizer type foods. And this is an event for honeybee members only. So if you want to go to this event, you're going to want to sign up to become a honeybee member of the garden. Then on August 12th, we have our family night in the garden. This is a dinner sponsored by Devonza's. So thank you, Devonza's, down at Devonza's. For this dinner, we'll have lots of fun activities for the kids. We'll do rock painting. We'll have different games and fun things for the kids to do. We'll also have music, and then Devonza's pizza will be available. And the last one we have scheduled is actually a free night of music in the garden. And this is music by Red Desert Ensemble. So this is, let's see, how do I explain their music? It's kind of immersive ensemble of clarinet and drums. It's kind of goes well with the landscape of the garden and very, very fun and very interesting. They also have interactive music, so they do pieces where you can come up and play with them, and that should be a lot of fun as well. So we have a lot going on in the garden this summer.
Okay, and then real quick, you've got some upcoming classes. What are those?
Yeah, so Upcoming on May 12th, we have Patrick Scherf is going to be teaching ecology and mindfulness. This is going to be a really interesting class. I'm really excited for it. Patrick is a wildlife biologist, and he really is passionate about, being mindful in nature. So mindful gardening, mindful walking, understanding how the world is working around you. So he's going to be talking about his specialty is predator-prey relationships and how we can use that to kind of better your garden. So noticing, you know, all the way from the microbiology, the bugs, and, you know, what are pests and how we use the predator to get the prey to help our garden, from that to attracting hawks to get the voles, and just when you walk around, noticing the details of what's happening around you. So this should be a really fun class. He's going to do some teaching and then walk around the garden and the surrounding area with everybody. So sign up for that. It's $10, but it's, you know, he's donating his time. He's happy to have anybody there. So if you want to just show up, that's fine. Come. It's going to be a really great class. And then the next class we have on May 20th is our happy hour cocktail making class in the garden. We did this last year, and it was just so much fun. Alpine Distilling will come, and we'll have all your ingredients available for making a fresh garden cocktail. And one of their bartenders will come and teach you how to make specialty cocktails. So the alcohol is not provided. When you sign up, we'll recommend that you go buy alcohol from Alpine Distilling, and then you come into the garden and learn how to make cocktails. So you can do it with or without alcohol, make it a cocktail or a mocktail. But it's just really fun to be outside and hear what they have to say and learn how to make some fresh garden cocktails.
Okay. Hey, Sloan, appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Leslie.